I want to encourage you to get a Bible. We're going to spend a significant amount of time this morning reading through texts. We're going to do a journey through Ezra this morning and parts of Zechariah. And I'm pausing because I'm trying to remember how I want to say Haggai. There we go. You can pronounce Haggai a couple of different ways, but if you don't know where Haggai and Zechariah is, they're towards the end of the Old Testament. Ezra's more towards the historical ones, 1st and 2nd Kings, Chronicles, Samuel, he'll be over there. But we're going to be reading through, jumping around in there this morning, so I want to give you a heads up to make sure you have a Bible. You can grab one on the back table if you need one, or you can share with your neighbor. So we're in the story. And again, the story is a chronological journey from the beginning to the end, from Genesis to Revelation. And our hearts are trying to capture a greater clarity of who God is and what He's doing. Again, I say this often, and I know you're in agreement with me, that again, this week, events happened and things took place in our world, and events happened in our own families and our own lives and our own relationships and our own finances and health and different things. Events happened this week that, again, bring us to that thinking of, you know, what does this all mean? And where is this going? And where is God? And what is He doing? And why is He doing what He's doing? And why is He not doing what I want Him to do? Right? Those questions. And it just continues to be that way. The world is continuing in this direction. And that's the intent of the story, is to try to get greater clarity on who God really is and what He's doing and this upper story, this eternal plan, the purposes of God and how the events on earth and the lower story, what is happening with people and how God is moving and shaping things, how they're connected and what does that mean for me? As a 53-year-old middle-aged guy in California, father, a grandfather, a husband, what does that mean for me? What does it look like for me to be in alignment with who God is and what He's doing? And so we're walking through this story that God has revealed to us. And last week, we left the Jewish nation that had ceased to be a nation in captivity, in exile is the word that is used in the Bible. They've been carried off, and we saw that God revealed that it would be a 70-year exile. And from the time that they first started getting deported, the northern tribes, the 10 tribes of Israel, because remember the nation had been broken into the 10 tribes of the north and the 2 of the south after Solomon died. There was a division of the kingdom, and the northern tribes had been, Assyria had come in and begun to carry away people. And so this deportation, this exile had begun to happen, and eventually the southern kingdom fell too, and we left the Jewish nation or the people of God, the Israelites, we left them in exile, in slavery. And God had come and said, in 70 years, I'll bring you back. Well, this morning, the book of Ezra gives us the beginning of that promise being fulfilled. Because we've seen this over and over in the story. When God makes a promise, He keeps it. Now, that's something to remind yourself of every day. No? Well, let me say it this way then. That's something I need to remind myself of every day, that when God makes a promise, He keeps a promise. He keeps it. Because in my circumstances, in my life, I sometimes lose sight of that. One of the great eye-opening elements of the story is that we see this over and over and over, and we're reminded that God has a long track record of keeping His promises. And that's what we see in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1. Just as He had promised, God begins to make His move. And I want you to remember that word move. If you've looked at your notes, you see that it's in your notes. But even more importantly, I want you to watch for it as we are walking through the passages that we're going to read this morning. Watch for God to move. In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, because guess what? The Babylonians had fallen. Nebuchadnezzar is no longer, and neither is his son or his grandson. The Medes and the Persians come in, and eventually Persia kind of rises to the top. And now Persia is in control. And so time has gone by, and in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah. Remember we read that last week. Jeremiah 29:11, chapter 30, chapter 31. God sent a letter through Jeremiah, who was back in Jerusalem, to those in exile in Babylon, and he said, in 70 years, I'll bring you back. So now, to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved. The Lord moved where? The Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, the king of Persia. Now, we could spend probably the rest of our morning right here kind of grappling with this and thinking about the ramifications of this statement that God, in his sovereignty and in his power and in his faithfulness to keep his promises, he has the ability, not only the power, but he has the will, he has the desire to move in the heart of someone that could care less about him and move in that person's life, in that person's heart, so that they would do God's bidding. Now, we're not going to spend the rest of the morning on here, but we need to pause here for a minute, because in our own circumstances, in our own situation, we too have people in authority over us, and the decisions those people make impact our lives. And we're faced with multiple moments of responding to that, right? Is God sovereign over those who have authority in our life, whether they know him or not, whether they serve him or not, whether they honor him or not, whether they believe in him or not? Is God sovereign, and is he powerful enough to control and to accomplish his purposes in the lives of those leaders, those with authority over our lives? You don't have to answer out loud, but I do want you to notice what it says here, and the lesson that is here for us here in this verse is that God moved in order to fulfill his plans to keep his promise, the word that he had spoken through Jeremiah. He moved in the heart of Cyrus, the king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and to put it in writing. So God moves in this man's life, and listen to what this king of Persia says. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any one of his people among you, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. And the people of any place where survivors may now be living are to provide him, that is the Israelite, the Jewish person going back to Jerusalem. They're to give this person returning, they're supplying him, providing them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock. Give them money, give them supplies, and with free will offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. Now you say, well, wait a minute, it sounds like Cyrus, he really is a worshiper of God. No, he's not. He still has his own gods. He hasn't changed the direction of his life. But what a powerful display of God's sovereignty and his ability to move by what we see God instilling in this man's heart and what this man proclaims. Guys, this is not normal for a conqueror, for a king, for one who has all power to say, you know, I think this group of people that we conquered, let's let them go back. Let them go back to their land, and let's allow them, not just allow them, let's pay for it. Let's pay for them to rebuild the temple so they can worship their God. The God, in fact, that has made all this possible for me. See, God is moving, and when God moves, incredible things happen, things that we can't explain. Things that have no human explanation, because they're not from human ability or endeavor. They're from God. And God is moving in this man's life. He makes this proclamation so that God can fulfill his promise. Then the family heads of Judah, they hear this proclamation, and Benjamin, and the priests, and the Levites, everyone whose heart God had moved. See, not all the Israelites went back. We don't talk about that too often. Some of them stayed. Some said, no, we like it here, we're gonna stay here, we like the culture, we like the businesses, we're going to stay. Not everybody went back. If you read on in this chapter, you'll see it was about 49, almost 50,000 people went back in this particular move. But again, we see God moving in the hearts of his own people, stirring in them a desire to go back to Jerusalem, to go back to a ruined city that was a mess. It was going to be a lot of work, but to go back and rebuild the temple. where God could then be worshiped and God could be known. He moved in the hearts of people, all those whose hearts God had moved, prepared to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. Took care of the loose ends of their lives, arranged for moving trucks, sold all, you know, had yard sales, garage sales, sold all the extra stuff, you know, like we do, sold their house if they needed to do that, and they got ready to go, and all their neighbors assisted them with articles of silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with valuable gifts, in addition to all the freewill offerings. Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles belonging to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God. Remember when Nebuchadnezzar's commander did that and he took all the articles that were used to worship God? Cyrus has given them back. And the neighbors and the people around are going, "What? You're going back to Jerusalem? Yes, that's where we're from, and we were carried here. Oh, us too. We came from wherever. Oh, well, we're going back. Cyrus says we can go back, and we get to rebuild the temple. Oh, well, you know what? Here, let me give you some money. Let me give you some livestock. What do you need? Come on. Is this normal? Is that how it was the last time you moved from your neighborhood? Maybe it was because they wanted you to move. But did your neighbors have a party and go, "Here, let's give you, we're giving you money. Go, leave. And here, take our car." What's happening? God is moving just as he promised. And he's moving in such a way that all the pieces are coming together so that his plans, his purposes are going to be fulfilled. This is such an amazing thing to me. This temple. And all that it says about God and all that it says about his relationship with his people, with people. And it's been completely destroyed. And now it's going to be rebuilt. But some of you know what's going to happen down the road, right? It's going to get destroyed again by the Romans. And then what does God promise then? He promised that one day, because is there a temple in Jerusalem right now? There's not. There's remnants. They've found some of what they believe to be the foundations, and the, you know, archaeologists have dug it up. But is there a grand temple in Jerusalem where God is worshipped? It's not a trick question, sorry. Everybody's afraid. No, there's not. But God says there will be. There will be. You see, God is committed to being with his people. God is committed to his presence being near to us. And the temple is the symbol. It speaks of that. It speaks of his heart. It speaks of his commitment. It speaks of his mercy and his grace, because this temple was destroyed because the people of God had forsaken him. And now he's moving and taking them back so they can rebuild it. And once again, they can experience his blessing and his closeness. So they go. In chapter 3 of Ezra, in chapter 3, verse 1, they go, this group of people go back, they arrive in Jerusalem in chapter 3, verse 1. When the seventh month came and the Israelites had settled in their towns, the people assembled as one man in Jerusalem. Then Yeshua, son of Jozadak, and his fellow priest, and Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and his associates began to build the altar of the Lord, or the altar of God of Israel, to sacrifice burnt offerings on it, in accordance with what is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So there's no temple, nothing's there, but they come together, and the first thing they do is the leaders, the priests and the Levites and those who are in charge, they begin to build an altar where they can offer sacrifices to God. They're preparing to do what? Worship. Right? They're back in the land. It's a giant mess. Nothing has happened yet, but they're back in the land, and God has promised that he's going to rebuild this temple. And so they begin to worship. Despite their fear of the peoples around them. See, there's no security. There's no wall around Jerusalem. There's no protection. When they're carried away, Nebuchadnezzar puts other people in their place. Some of the poor left, but then he brings in other. He's moving everybody around purposely. And he moves other people into this area. And so now they've settled there. And they're not friends of the Jewish nation. They do not want the Jewish nation to rise again. They don't want the temple built. And the Jews know that. And so there's some concerns. There's some safety concerns. But despite that, or in spite of their fear of the peoples around them, they build the altar on its foundation. And they sacrificed burnt offerings on it to the Lord, knowing full well the culture around them is not going to embrace it. It's going to be against what they're doing. But they go ahead and they do it anyways, both the morning and the evening sacrifices. Then, in accordance with what is written, They celebrate the Feast of the Tabernacles with the required number of burnt offerings prescribed for each day. After that, they presented the regular burnt offerings, the new moon sacrifices, and the sacrifices for all the appointed sacred feasts of the Lord, as well as those brought, that is, sacrifices that were brought as freewill offerings, above and beyond their tithes and their gifts, what they wanted to bring to God. On the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord, even though the foundation of the Lord's temple had not yet been laid. They come together, they build an altar, they begin to worship God, and they celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Tents, or Huts. One of the three, there were seven feasts, and three of them they were required to go to Jerusalem. This was one of them. And this was a seven-day festival that they lived outside. They moved out of their homes, and they would live in a lean-to made out of certain types of branches. And the reason they did that is because God wanted them to remember their 40 years of living in temporary housing in the wilderness, and how God had been faithful to them, and their shoes didn't wear out, and all those things, the manna, the water, all the things that he had provided for them, and how good he was, how faithful he was to a bunch of rebellious people. For 40 years, he provided for them and took care of them. And he wanted them to remember that. And when they come back after being gone for 70 years, they celebrate this feast, this festival to God. God is good and he's faithful, and he's brought us back. And they worship God. They worship God. You see, every move that God makes, every time he moves among people, it's accompanied by worship. A true move of God will result in the worship of God. It's happened throughout history. In any kind of revival, any kind of miraculous move that we just can't pin on people, that it clearly is God moving, restoring, rebuilding. Something God is doing. When God moves, it always includes worship. And that's a lesson for us. That's a lesson for me. That whenever God is working and moving in my life, in our life, in an area, in a country, whatever God is moving, what is the right response to that? It's worship. It's worship. Their country is a mess. They have no security. They have no safety. The temple's in ruins. The city is in ruins. But they're back, and God brought them here, and we're going to first, before we build anything or do anything else, we've put our boxes in our homes, and we've kind of got them settled, started to unpack, and now what we're going to do is we're going to worship. We're going to celebrate God. We're going to remember his faithfulness to us. Every move of God includes worship. And why is that? Because what worship does is it focuses on us on who is doing the moving and who this is ultimately about. See, when God moves in my life, I'm sometimes a little bit slow to capture that it's really not about me, it's really about him. It's really about him doing something through me. That it's not just, I'm not the end of the delivery. You know, I buy stuff online. I love getting deals. I love Amazon. By the way, if you go into smile.amazon.com, here's a commercial. You pick a charity, we're in there. You can pick Crossroads Church, and then a little bit of what you spend goes to Crossroads Church. Okay, end of commercial. I like buying stuff online. I love getting deals. But you know my favorite part? Is when there's that, You know, the days of signing are pretty much over, but you hear that, or ding dong, I have stairs at my house. And you run down the house, and then you open the door, and there's this package there. And you take the package, and you open it up, and you because maybe I have multiple packages coming, so I'm not sure which one it is. And you open it up, and there it is. You know what came yesterday? I was so excited. New ink for my printer. Yeah, big deal. But, I'm the end of that line. I'm the end of that process. And it's, for me, it's I get this gift. I get this thing that I enjoy, hopefully. And I think that we have that same mindset. I know I've been guilty of it. That when God moves, when God comes through, when God delivers, and he's moving in a situation, that I think I'm the end of the line, that it's for me. Now, do I get from that? I absolutely do. As they are doing, are getting. And God gives me things and joy and peace in receiving the way that he's moving. But he's not moving in and of itself for me. He's moving because he wants to be known. He wants people to know who he is. He's always about his business. He's always about his business of drawing people to himself, to preserving and building a remnant that might speak for him, might live for him, might be lights for him. And guys, if you're part of the church, you put your faith in Christ, today it's us. It's the church, just as it was the nation of Israel in that day. You see, we worship when he moves because worship focuses us on who is doing the moving and who it's ultimately about. The flip side, if I don't do that, I don't worship when he moves, you know what happens over time? And please, if this is you, then just take this as a word from God and take the steps that are necessary. But this is what happens to us. We become spoiled little Christians. We become spoiled little... Right, I didn't want to say it because there are some kids. But and that may not be a word that we use in every household. But you get the picture? We become spoiled little Christians when we see God's move as being about us. Because now all I can think about is the next one, the next gift, the next thing that I want God to do. Whenever God moves, there's always an element of worship. And the reason that is so is because worship focuses us on who is doing the moving and who this is really about. Because this really is about God's name being known to the world, that he's bringing about this move. So the rest of chapter 3, or part of chapter 3, we see them building the house of God. They begin to start it. It's interesting in verse 11, if you look at verse 11 of chapter 3, it says this, "With praise and thanksgiving they sing to the Lord." Now, is worship just singing? No, it's not. Good, good. We get that, right? It's lots of different things. But is singing intended to be worship? Is it a way that we worship? It is, right? And it's one that we recognize. We did it this morning. We're going to do it again this morning in response to bring God praise and thanksgiving and to worship him. When God's moving and they're back in the land, they start to build. One of the first things they do is they sing with praise and thanksgiving. They sang to the Lord. And here's their song. We're given two lines. He is good. His love to Israel endures forever. He is good. His love to Israel endures forever. Hey, guys, we're back. We're back in the land. This is good. Things are going to happen. And they sing. Now, they sing quietly, it says in the end of verse 11, right? And all the people whispered praise to the Lord because the foundation of the house had been laid. No, they don't, right? There's a time to sing soft. There's a time to be reflective. This morning, Jeff asked us to just kind of quietly contemplate as he played, and we thought about the holiness of God and what our response to that should be, right? And it was quiet. But it's just as equally legitimate sometimes to make a lot of noise and to shout. Do a word search sometime, a Bible study, and use a concordance or use a website and see how many times it says shout in the Old Testament. Then read those passages and see how many of them are connected to the worship of God. You're going to find a lot. A lot of times God is saying, shout, make a great noise, a great shout of praise to the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. The building had begun. But many of the older priests and Levites and family heads who had seen the former temple. Now, these are old, old people, right? I mean, this is over 70 years later. So, I mean, these are like my dad. No. These are seasoned people. But they had seen the former temple before Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed it. And they wept aloud when they saw the foundation of this temple being laid. Many others were shouting for joy. Nobody could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise, and the sound was heard far away. You know, there's things here we could hover on, but I think we'll just leave it at that. There's just times to make lots of noise for God. I went to a Kings game this week. Somebody gave me tickets, and my daughter and I went to a Kings game, and you know what? At a sporting event, we have no problem making. In fact, the microphone kept saying, make some noise, make some noise. For that, no, sorry. It was a terrible game. But, you know, we'll go to a sporting event, so we'll make noise for that. But God says, make noise for me. Let it be known who you think I am and how you feel about me and how you see me. Get excited. Yes, there were those that were thinking about what used to be and all that had been lost. And they were weeping, but there were a lot of people making loud noise of worship to God. So loud that it's going to be heard. The sound was heard far away, and it's going to bring some consequences. As we read through chapter 4, you'll be reading this in your reading this week as you spend time in the story and as we gather as families to go through this. And our children are being taught right now this part of the story. As you walk through this, you're going to see that there's this pattern of resistance to what God is doing. And people are going to step up to try to stop what God is doing. Chapter 4, verse 1, when the enemies of Judah and Benjamin heard that the exiles were building a temple for the Lord, the God of Israel, they came to Zerubbabel and to the heads of the family and said, "Hey, let us help you build, because like you, we seek your God, and we've been sacrificing to him since the time of Yarshadon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." But Zerubbabel, Yeshua, and the rest of the heads of the families of Israel answered, "You have no part with us in building a temple to our God. We alone will build it, for the Lord, the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of Persia, commanded us." Then the priests around them set out to these same people that said, "No, we're with you, and we've been worshiping the same God. We want to help you." The people around them set out to discourage the people of Judah and to make them afraid to go on building. They hired counselors to work against them and frustrate their plans during the entire reign of Cyrus, king of Persia, and down to the reign of Darius, king of Persia. So there's this resistance. There's the people around them do not want this to happen. And whenever there's a move of God, there's going to be pushback. Not everybody is excited about what God is doing. Have you found that to be true? Sometimes I'm not even excited about what God is doing. Sorry if you're shocked. But truthfully, there's times when he's moving and it's like, no, that is so inconvenient. No, God, that is way too hard. Because I know what I see you moving and I know what you want me to do and I know my part and I don't want to do it. That's too hard. Or that's too important to me. See, I'm not always excited about what God is doing and how he's moving. The principle, the truth is that whenever God moves, there's going to be resistance to that move, sometimes internally, often externally, around us. Sometimes it comes from within our own family, our own workplace. Sadly, sometimes it happens within our own church. Right? There's always pushback. There's always resistance when God moves. In verse 6 of chapter 4, at the beginning of the reign of Xerxes, a new king is over this area, ruling from Persia, and they lodged an accusation against the people of Judah and Jerusalem. They go to them and they say, "These people are building this temple," and you'll read it there in chapter 4. "These people are a threat. They're building this temple and they're going to worship this God. And the government needs to step in. The government needs to stop these people, because if the government doesn't, the government is going to be threatened by what is happening here. And you need to shut it down. You need to shut it down." They're in rebellion. They use strong words. Strong words. They go to the king and they say, "The Jews are in rebellion against you and they are a threat to your rule." Chapter 4. Let me read just a few more verses. "As soon as the copy of the letter of King Artaxerxes was read to Rehum and Shimshai, the secretary, and their associates, they went immediately to the Jews in Jerusalem." They'd gotten word back from the government, and they compelled them by force to stop. They got authority from the king, they came back to where the temple work was being done, and they physically stopped them. Thus the work on the house of God in Jerusalem came to a standstill until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. The point is, I've already made it, but it's one that we need to grab a hold of. Whenever God moves, there's going to be resistance. There's going to be resistance. Now, what do I do with that? Well, if the resistance is coming internally, then I need to deal with that. Follow me? If it's me, if I don't like what God's doing, then I got to figure that out. I got to get right with God. I got to come to my knees, and either I'm going to move with him or I'm not. If it's coming externally, I need to be committed and prepared to move with God, regardless of what pressure or pushback or resistance happens around me. Right? This is not just a one day, one week, one year. This goes on for years. This resistance and this pushback and this plotting and all that's going on, it goes on for a very long time. In the midst of all this, all this is happening, God, allowing it to happen and play out according to his plan and his timing, but he's not absent. He's still moving. And the way he moves is he comes to his people during this time of discouragement. Did you catch that, what they were trying to do? They're trying to discourage them, and they're trying to instill fear in them. Wow. Those are great tactics, aren't they? No, come on. Think about it. If we're discouraged or if we're afraid, what are we going to do for God? I see shaking heads because we've been there, right? We do nothing for God. We stop. But has God stopped? No, he continues to move and he's going to address this discouragement and this fear. And what he does is he sends Haggai and Zechariah, two of his prophets, to come speak to his people. Look at chapter 5, verse 1. Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the prophet, a descendant of Edo, prophesied to the Jews in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel son of Shealtiel and Yeshua son of Jozadak set to work to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem. Do you see what's happening here? The prophets of God were with them, helping them. What is happening? How is God moving? God is moving by sending his prophets to come to them and say, hey. No, look at me. You, Diane, look at me. Look at me. I know you're discouraged and I know you're full of fear, but God is in this and God's going to do this. So get back to work. No more fear. No more discouragement. Get back to work. I'm going to do this. I'm with you. And he encourages them through his prophets. These texts are in your notes this morning. In Haggai chapter 1, God, let me just distill it. Verses 1 through 8, God says this. He says, build my house. He says, build my house. In fact, he says, this is going to prepare the way for me to bless you and be with you. He says, you notice how you've tried to plant crops and not a whole lot's coming up? And you're going through a drought and different things are happening and you're working hard, but you're getting very little effort. He says, guys, you're taking care of your families, that's great, and you're planning and you're building your houses, but I really want to be central to all that you do, so build my house. If you build my house, I will bless you. If you'll prepare the place for me to meet with you, and I will be, again, central to your lives. See, the temple represented God's blessing, his presence, that he was number one. Remember what the temple is about. It's about worship. And for them, it was about bringing him stuff all the time. You frustrated with what it takes to get you here on Sunday morning or, you know, the rain or how the time of the service or, you know, things aren't going the way you want them to. Or then we talk about money and you're asking us to give money and you're asking us to sing and you're asking us to serve. And we're like, oh, oy, they. You know, every time I come, it's like I'm being asked to give something. Yes. Yes. That's exactly what worship is. It's bringing God us and giving it to him. And for them, the temple represented, they were constantly bringing the best of their animals and coming to the festivals. And imagine 3 times a year having to pack up everything and go to Washington, D.C. on your dime. And then living in a hut that you make for 7 days with your family. Oh, God asks stuff from them all the time. That's worship. We bring him us. And God says, build that temple. Put that unmistakable, prominent building, boom, right on the hill. And come to it all the time and worship me and bring your life to me. Come to me when you're sinful and I'll forgive you. Come to me when you're needy and I'll provide for you. Just come worship me. Lift me up so everybody can see who I am. He says, build the house because it puts me at the center of your lives or provides the opportunity for that. And he goes on in Haggai chapter 2, God says this through his prophet, I'm with you. I am with you. You read it this week. He says, I'm with you. It's hard, and there's resistance, and there's people that don't like you and don't want this to happen. But guys, I'm doing this. I'm moving. This is me, and I'm with you. As you're building and as you're sacrificing, as you're living your life there, and you're obeying me, he says, I am with you. Oh, I think of the words of Jesus in Matthew 28. I find it so easy to put myself in the shoes of those 12, those 11 guys on that hill when they show up and it says some doubt. There's me, you know, in some worship, there's me. And he's there and he says, I have all authority. And I'm thinking, oh man, that's hard to really grab a hold of and believe that and live that. And then he says, go make disciples of all nations. What? Yes, leave where you're at. Go to where you've not gone before and make disciples and baptize and teach. And then he says what? I'll be with you always until the very end of the age. That's Jehovah in human flesh. That's Jehovah, that's Creator in human flesh, repeating what God is saying here through Haggai, the same message, same God, saying, I'm with you. Whatever you're walking through, whatever you're dealing with, I'm moving, I'm doing something, I'm building my kingdom, I'm going to get my temple built because I want people to worship me, and I want you to do it, and I'm with you. I'm with you. Zechariah chapter 1, the message is this, verses 7 through 17. God says, I keep my promises. You read it. He says, I keep my promises. If I make a promise, I keep it. Build my house, I am with you, I keep my promises. Here's the third principle of when God moves, it's this. God is always present in his move. God is always present in his move. God is always central, front and center, leading his move. I said, wait a minute, we're the ones doing the work, it seems, and we're the ones that are paying the price, and yep, we're the ground troops. There's no question. There's no question. We're infantry. They were infantry. They're picking up shovels. They're picking up picks. Some are, well, you can read about it when they build the wall in Nehemiah. Some have swords. Some have picks. They're blood, sweat, and tears. They're doing the work. That's what infantry does. That's what the front lines do. That's what we are. And right smack dab in the middle of us is him. Because he's with us. He's with us. And he keeps his promises. He's going to provide. He takes care of us. He never leaves us. I am with you always to the very end of the age. See, God is always front and center. He's always right in the middle of his move. Why is that important? Because the truth is, we too get discouraged and we get afraid. Is that the right way to say that? Get afraid? Become afraid? Okay, my teachers are all... they're probably all passed away, but they're, you know, moaning about, oh, he didn't listen. We get discouraged and we get afraid. I'm going to stick with that. We become afraid. We get scared. No? Yeah, we do. And what do I need when I am discouraged or I am afraid? What I need to know that right here is my God. Right here is the eternal Holy Spirit of God living in me. And he will never leave me or forsake me. So whatever it is I'm doing or not doing, and I'm discouraged or I'm scared to death, at the end of the day, I need to come back to that reality that God is right here. Because he's always present, front and center, right in the middle of his move. He moves with us. One more thought this morning. Ezra chapter 5. We see that the resistance continues. It's funny to me. I don't know, may not be too, but to me it's funny. They basically come and say, hey, wait a minute. Do you have a permit? Do you have a permit to build this building? Do you have a building permit? Who signed off on this? Knock it off, shut down, construction site, chained up, because you don't have a permit. And they send a letter. They go back to headquarters. They go back to the seat of government, back to Persia, and they say, these people are building a building and they don't have a permit. Now, it's funny to me because it seems so current, you know, to types of issues that we deal with and setbacks and problems we deal with. But even more interesting, and this is why it really sticks with me, is that God moves and they find the permit. And I love what the permit says. Look at chapter 6, verse 3. Look at chapter 6, verse 3. It says, moratorium, permit, declaration. Here's the authority for this building, this temple of Jehovah to be built. In the first year of King Cyrus, the king issued a decree, a building permit, concerning the temple of God in Jerusalem. Here's the permit. Let the temple be rebuilt as a place to present sacrifices and let its foundations be laid. It is to be 90 feet high and 90 feet wide, with three courses of large stones and one of timbers. The cost are to be paid by the royal treasury. The county of Sacramento not only issued a permit, but they agreed to pay for it. What? Not going to happen. But it did in that day. Also, the gold and the silver, the articles, the gold and silver articles of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, are to be returned to their places in the temple of Jerusalem. We're to furnish the temple. They are to be deposited in the house of God. Now then, Tattenai, governor of Trans-Euphrates, and Shethar Boznai, I'm thankful that you already named your son, because I know you'd be tempted here. And you, their fellow officials of the province, stay away from there. Do not interfere with the work on this temple of God. Let the governor of the Jews and the Jewish elders rebuild the house of God on its site. Moreover, I hereby decree what you are to do for these elders of the Jews in the construction of this house of God. Not only are you to not resist them and let them be, but you're also to do this. The expenses of these men are to be fully paid for out of the royal treasury from the revenues of the Trans-Euphrates, this section of the kingdom, so that the work will not stop. Pay for it. Pay the leaders. Whatever is needed, young bulls, rams, male lambs for burnt offerings to the God of heaven, and wheat and salt and wine and oil as requested by the priests. Whatever they ask for must be given to them daily without fail, so that they may offer sacrifices pleasing to the God of heaven and pray to the well-being of the king and his sons. Furthermore, I decree that if anyone changes this edict, a beam is to be pulled from his house. That means it's to fall down. You take out the supporting beam. And he is to be lifted up and killed. You see what it says there, right? And for his crime, this crime, his house is to be made a pile of rubble. May God, who has caused his name to dwell there on that temple, overthrow any king or people who lifts a hand to change this decree or to destroy this temple in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have decreed it. Let it be carried out with diligence. Man, nobody can do a building permit like God. Seriously, that's a building permit. I just love that God shares that with us, that it's found. Because again, it speaks to who it is that's doing this. That no matter what we see as an impenetrable obstacle, whoever is against us and their authority and their power, God is bigger and God is greater in every way. If he's in the move, it happens. The permit is found. The rest of chapter 16, or chapter 6, it tells us that the temple is finished, and then they celebrate. They celebrate the Passover. They celebrate the Passover and the 7 days, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The temple is finished, and they celebrate the Passover. They celebrated the Feast of Tents, the Feast of Tabernacles, to remember the goodness, the faithfulness of God. The temple is built, and now they celebrate Passover, which reminds us of what? God's redemptive plan. Right? What does Passover remind us of? What does the Lord's table remind us of? It reminds us of that we're sinful people. And we have sin that needs to be paid for, that needs to be covered. And the way it's going to be covered is by shed blood. And the shed blood of the Lamb, the Messiah, the promised one, the anointed one, would be sent, and he would come and live among us, and he would shed his blood, and he would give his life for me and for you. See what's happening here again in the story? We're brought back again to God's upper story, his redemptive plan. It's always about God redeeming what has been lost, what sin has stolen and destroyed. He's trying to redeem, not trying, he is successfully redeeming back. And they celebrate the Passover. Here's the last thought. You can't stop a move of God. Government can't, all the issues, finances, building permits, whatever it is. Whatever hassle, whatever pushback, whatever enemy there is that exists against the move of God, you cannot stop the move of God. These people said, hey, you can't build. Shut it down. Go check and see if they got a permit. They got a permit. They do? Yeah. And if we try to stop them, they're going to tear our house down and bury us, kill us in the house. What? Yeah, it gets worse. What do you mean it gets worse? We have to pay for it. What? We have to pay for it. We have to pay the leaders. We have to supply the stuff so they can do the sacrifices and give them whatever the priests need and ask for. We gotta pay for it all. Ah! You can't stop God. When God moves, you can't stop it. You can join it. You can resist it. You can celebrate it, but you won't stop it. You can join it. You can resist it. You can celebrate it, but you won't stop it. So God's moving. He's still moving today. The question that I'm faced with that I throw out to each of us as we close is, what am I going to do in response to that move? Am I going to join it? Am I going to resist it? Am I going to celebrate it? And that's a question that each of us has to answer in our own hearts with God, right? He's moving. Will we move with him or not? Let's pray together. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the details that are here, God. I thank you for the insight that you give us into, as to who you are and how you move and how you work. God, you're so powerful. You're so faithful. You're so sovereign. And you're so merciful and patient with us as you were with these people, as you've always been. God, I pray that you would convict us in our hearts. And as we respond this morning in these next moments, the few moments that we have left together, God, help us not to waste them or miss the moment. You're moving. You're drawing people to yourself. You're building your kingdom. You're building the church. God, convict us in our hearts if we are on board with that and we are in of one mind and one spirit with you so that we're willing to be a part of that and to go wherever you tell us to go and to be and to do whatever it is, to be a part of how you're moving. God, if there's resistance in our heart, if there's anger or bitterness or fear or discouragement, God, I pray your spirit would work in each of your children this morning. And if we're not your child, God, we've not trusted in your son, draw that life, that heart to yourself right now. Open up the eyes of that heart to see the depths of your love for them and why Jesus came and died on the cross, so that they might be washed clean, restored, forgiven, and that then they too can move with you. God, I pray that you just would rule, be king of our hearts in these next few moments. Even now as we give, we bring you our gifts and offerings as the people then did. They brought their animals, they brought their first fruits, they brought it to you to worship you. So as we give now in these next moments, God, may we worship you in what we give you. A part of what you've blessed us with. Help us to be generous. Help us to be cheerful. Help us to be people of faith that will entrust our lives and trust our care to you. In Jesus' name, amen.